Thanks. Now, you did mention Fraternity Renaissance. You were there for that whole major disruption.
Yeah, I mean...
Can you describe what it was like to have Lexington as torn up as it apparently was?
Well, now you see, what I was there for, it probably wasn't as... I mean, I graduated in 91, so I don't know how much disruption we were experiencing. I mean, it was fear. I mean, there was fear because what it really meant was that things were going to become uniform. And all the worst fears about the university could be visited upon these fraternities, in the sense that there was a core group of men who, you know, fused with this conservative politics and a periodical they started. And a lot of this was anti-John Wilson, anti-John Elrod, Randy Bazanson. It was that whole Midwestern sort of mafia that came from Iowa and Michigan and brought in certain, you know, they saw draconian equalitarian ideas. And what this meant was that, you know, the fraternity houses no longer owned, I mean, this is how my fellow students saw it. And I, you know, as a representative on the executive council, you know, my feelings against Fraternity Renaissance or fraternities hadn't become that strong. So, but it was still my duty to listen to what my fellow classmates were saying and to try and articulate this whenever I had the opportunity to have John Wilson's ear or any trustee's ear. And, you know, so I was very interested in what these men had to say. And, you know, I still read. I mean, I read the New York Times last week about they're banning alcohol, you know, from some fraternities now. And I read the editorials of alums and fathers who just thought this was awful. You know, there's a certain mentality in this country about what their sons should be allowed to do. And, you know, this was a lot what was being articulated, because they knew that no one wanted their house to become Fiji. They wanted a nice house like the Fiji fraternity across the street from Dick Sessoms, but they didn't want Dick Sessoms, as nice of a guy as he is, or Ferris Hotchkiss, or Randall Bazanson, all the people who were neighbors of the Fijis while we were there, you know, to have such an intimate role in their brotherhood. You know, a house mother, oh God, I mean, it was not the idealized fraternity experience that they had, which, you know, somewhat, even, you know, my roommates and I, it was the whole Animal House mentality. I mean, at that time, that was seen sort of as the rite of passage, that, you know, you would have these crazy parties, and there'd be lots of alcohol consumed, and there would just be chaos and pandemonium and fun. And Fraternity Renaissance, I think, for a lot of those guys, meant that this would change. I mean, there would be these standards, the house would be, I mean, everyone wanted their houses renovated, but they just didn't want the fact that the university would own the land. Because if the university owned the land, then they could turn it into Gaines Dormitory. And, you know, no one wanted to live in Gaines Dormitory.
Why?
Well, I think that they didn't like the social engineering of it.
Tell me what you mean by that.
Well, you know, there was a lot of reaction against, I think it was seen as John Wilson and John, or not so specifically John Elrod, because most people didn't know. I mean, they knew he was Dean Elrod and Vice President of Academic Affairs. But, you know, I'm trying to think, what was it that they said about John Wilson? He brought in coeducation. And that same year, they changed from Coke to Pepsi, I think, in the vending machines. I mean, this was awful. I mean, he was considered the Antichrist. And that, you know, associated with everything he did. There was nothing that John Wilson did that a whole cadre of students and alums could like. which was really, really unfortunate. And so there was also this idea that the student body was changing, that the students were becoming too intelligent. And I sat in, you know, when I was president of the student body of trustees meetings, and I guess you'll probably want to edit it, but I think, I can't remember whether it was Beau DeBose, but he was just like, you know, I'm worried now. I mean, his son was at Washington and Lee. But you even heard trustees voicing this opinion, you know, are we radically changing the core students at Washington and Lee? And they were concerned that, you know, the SAT scores were getting too high and that their sons and daughters maybe wouldn't be getting in. And Hartog, Dean Hartog would, you know, say, I remember, it was a wonderful trustees meeting. He said, you know, your SAT scores, when everything's adjusted, were actually the highest, like the class of 62, 63, 64. He said, the university has not approached that yet. He said, actually, we've been trying to raise them back up to that, to convince these people, you know, that the student body wasn't radically changing. You know, there were a handful of more black students and a handful of more international students on the campus. But the campus was still overwhelmingly, you know, white and Christian and fairly affluent. Yes, there were people with more, I think people who were coming to grips with the reality that, you know, if you wanted to get a professional degree or, you know, you wanted to go on to graduate school, you know, academics were becoming much, much more of a serious issue. And I mean, I think there was maybe some change. I mean, there were people who didn't see, I think, fraternity life as first and foremost. And, you know, our class was picked on because I think Bernadette Kempton, the valedictorian in my class, Bernadette at the time, was approaching the highest GPA in the history of Washington and Lee. And, you know, Bernadette was just, you know, feared because she worked hard and she did really well. And she had, you know, I think she may have graduated a 4.1 or something, or maybe a 4.0 something. And there was just sort of, you know, this is just craziness. And so all of this was associated with John Wilson. And I'm hoping that my classmates don't remember that as, and I'm sure that they don't. They have to have forgotten the politics and the battles. But they saw it very much for the heart and soul of the Washington and Lee that they inherited, to the Washington and Lee that they had applied to. The class of pledges that I was in were sort of looked upon both by ourselves and I think by later students in awe because we were the last pledge class to go through with the last all-male class. There was this constant effort to grab onto something of the old Washington and Lee. When things were before the arrival of women and Anne Shore Lamont, and you know, a lot of this has to do with political correctness and stuff like that. I mean, they saw liberal orthodoxy being imposed upon Washington and Lee, and in fact, it wasn't liberal orthodoxy.
not really.
I think John Elrod probably had been a little more liberal. I think he's come closer to appreciate the institution that he runs now, and I think that there's been sort of this dialectic where he's absorbed a lot of the institution and community, and I think he's kind of had an appreciation, and he's probably learned from John Wilson how best to do the things that will improve the university and make it a great institution, but to try and be less controversial. I mean, in the end, it wasn't that bad. I mean, I don't know what it's like now. I don't know if alcohol isn't allowed on campus. I haven't been back for, I was unable to attend my fifth year reunion. But I had been going back at other times, more random times. Actually, I think I went back immediately after my first year of law school. I went back October for, I think, homecoming. And that was the last time that I went back when there was basically students there. All the other times I visited, it's been to see my friends from the faculty. So, excuse me, I think that was a lot of the political culture that survived. And by the time I became president of the student body, things were becoming a lot more tense, because then the whole plans for fraternity renaissance were becoming more concrete, and the idea that there were house mothers, and I mean, it really became an issue that they thought that, I mean, while I was there, there was this organization called the Confidential Review Committee, and it was to deal with issues of discrimination on based upon gender and race, and it was set up, and it somewhat went outside the traditional regime set up for disputes between students that had originally been part of the student constitution, and there was a lot of secrecy associated with the organization and its procedures. And it was an attempt on the part of the university to try and address the needs of its students who were of color, who were not their traditional students, not the school's traditional constituency. And there were problems with race. I know that happened. And unfortunately, there was a certain amount of deference, I think, shown on the part of my classmates who were black towards me because I was elected. And they sometimes hid these things from me. I'm not sure, maybe it was because I appeared to be an unsympathetic individual, which would really be unfortunate. Or that they wanted to deal with it on their own and didn't want to make an issue and didn't feel that as an EC representative, it was appropriate for general student discussion. But I remember learning of an incident where either a noose and a little cross or a piece of tissue with a wad of tissue inside of it was burned outside of a black student's door and in Gaines, which was the place where students of all backgrounds and different classes, I mean university ranking would come together. And you know, I remember hearing about this, and I heard about it a few months later, and I was absolutely devastated that it hadn't been shared with me. I don't know what I would have done. There were clearly people on campus who in the administration were very capable of handling it. Maybe I would have brought it, I probably would have brought it up in the EC meeting, because I would have tried to expand what honor meant. And to remind, and I think I did remind my classmates, reading General Lee's definition of a gentleman, how you treated someone who was different from you, even if you perceived them to be, in his day, a slave, that you treated them with respect. Now, whether or not General Lee actually did that, I don't know, but that was his rhetoric. Unfortunately, a rhetoric that most people in this country who subscribe and elevate him to a saint don't really like to hear. But I think I maybe even read that one day when I was president of the student body from the EC meeting and put it in the minutes to let people know, look, this is what is most important. It's not lying, cheating, and stealing. It's how you conduct yourself with your fellow student, with a faculty member, with a member of the staff, with anyone in town. You know, it was to remove this whole privileged mentality. So I don't know, but I remember being very disappointed and kind of hurt and almost embarrassed that I found out about that incident many months after it happened. obviously, well, maybe I had been too consumed in the developing politics of the university that I didn't take those concerns. But I always felt that I was a member of the minority students at Washington and Lee. And I should have, I don't know, I probably should have been more involved. And I would have known about that. Not to say that I didn't have racial problems when I was there. I remember being with my girlfriend at the time from Sweetbriar, and someone from Sigma Chi had yelled a racial epithet out of the window of the fraternity house. And this was like when I was a junior or even a senior. I must have been a junior. But those aren't my predominant memories of Washington and Lee. And unfortunately, you know, talking to the other people that I know, contemporaries of mine, who've gone to school all over the country, I mean, these experiences, I mean, it's part of being an American, and it's part of being black in America. I can't say Washington and Lee was any worse or any better. So I don't hold that against the institution. There were stupid things that the university did. My most recent conversation with Washington and Lee was the photograph in the April calendar of this month. I got my calendar, like I get everything from Washington and Lee, and I just ripped through it. I mean, I want to see the pictures. I want to read the articles. I look forward to an alumni magazine. For some reason, the law school has me on their mailing list, and maybe because I have a JD. And I have a number of friends, faculty friends over at the law school. But so I even read the law stuff. And so I got the calendar, and for the month of April, there's a picture of Traveler's Grave, which I used to pass, you know, at least once or twice a week. I had all these Confederate flags stuck in it. So I'm thinking, it's like, look, there were never any of these Confederate flags when I was a student there. I was like, why are they here in this picture? You know, when I became president of the student body, they had to go to the KA house and meet with them and assure them that I was not going to take the flags down out of Lee Chapel, as if I, president of the student body, would have ever had the authority to take those battle flags that followed and that General Lee had carried into battle with him in the Army of Northern Virginia. I mean, I thought those flags were very appropriate to be there. And that was one of the things that impressed me about Washington Lee. I mean, there weren't Confederate flags all around the school. I mean, except for what the students had. Now, a close reading of what General Lee's words were, like the stars and bars are not supposed to hang anymore. We're not supposed to wear these Confederate uniforms. You know, I really need to go back through. There's a book, Lee, The Last Years, and I read that, I think, my first semester there, which I think allowed me to get to know General Lee. And now that I'm pursuing my PhD in history, I really haven't revisited to see what the historiography of the book is and whether this guy Flood is really a good historian or not, or whether it's just celebratory. But I remember somewhere in that book, and I've since lent the book to a colleague of mine at my old law firm, he has the book. I guess I've given him the book now. But there was somewhere in there about the whole uniforms and the flag, and he was just like, put it away. The war's over. You know, it shouldn't be there. And with the exception of those battle flags, Washington and Lee lived up to that. You know, it's not like the Citadel or any of these institutions where, you know, the Confederate flags paraded around. So I get to April, and I'm just like, I can't believe this. So this month, or last month, in April was up in my room, and it just irritated me. And I've just been so busy this first year of graduate school that I hadn't done anything about it. Well, I had now received 2-3 letters from the development people about my annual fund contribution, along with three or four letters from Boston College Law School. So I was just like, look, I have such a tight budget. I can't, I'm not going to be able to give both to BC and give both to Washington and Lee. And I'm so exercised by these Confederate flags. And I mean, if you look at it, I mean, there's no purpose that the flags are there. I mean, it's sort of this little glorification. I mean, you see the flags first, then you see Traveler's Grave. So after receiving my final, another letter in June that I had not made my contribution yet, and I've been, that's why I asked you for John's email address and also for Patrick's. And I figured that I really hadn't spoken to the Allrods recently except exchange Christmas cards, and it would be unfair of me to burden him with that. And so I contacted Patrick. And Patrick got back to me the next day. He had been out of town. And so I explained to him, and he said, well, you know, the flags were there. And I thought it would just be a good shot. And he said part of the decision was mine. It was probably Brian's. And he mentioned someone else. And you're right, we should have been more sensitive. As to your contribution to the annual fund, it sounds like Patrick probably doesn't want this in, but he was just like, I was going to give it to the indigent criminal defense program that I had participated in at BC, and they really need the money because they get clothes and stuff for the indigent defendants they represented in Dorchester Criminal Court, District Court. And we were always short on funds, so he agreed. He said, you know, the university's not going to be made or broken over your $50, and said, I don't think you're going to get any type of apology for it or anything. And so he said, you know, it's probably better if you give it to BC this year. And I said, yeah, I'm gonna do that. And he conceded that they should have been perhaps more sensitive. So then he said, well, you know, I should tell you that they're restoring the battle flags, and there are new flags up in the chapel that are brighter. I said, Patrick, I don't have a problem with the flags there. I don't even have a problem with reproductions there. I said, because they're appropriate. I said, what I have a problem with is that, you know, whether you all did it or someone else did it, stuck these other Confederate flags in Traveler's Grave. They were never there. There's no point in them being there. And I said, it's just everything surrounding it. I said, it's not like the governor of Virginia right now hasn't just made this National Confederate History Month. I said, this is a typical Washington and Lee reaction, where you kind of do something so clumsy and belligerent against the backdrop of other people doing something clumsy and belligerent. So
Patrick shared that conversation with me, and I was really glad he did. I was really glad you made the phone call, because I'd looked at that picture and I hadn't seen what you saw. I just saw Traveler's Grave with something colorful on it. Now that you've pointed it out, I'll never look at it again without seeing them there. And I wanted to ask your opinion about a photograph that I'm thinking about using in the book, which I've shown to several of the first black graduates of Washington and Lee, but I haven't shown it to anyone your age or younger. It's a picture of the minstrel shows they used to have back in the 50s. What's your reaction as a black alum, and your reaction as a historian to the potential of seeing that in the official history of Washington and Lee?
Well, I should begin with describing my scholarship and my intended academic field. I intend to become a Latin Americanist. So my exposure to American history is Hope Merchant class and David Parker's survey class on American history. I have been exposed to lots of colonial images, images of, how the, quote, other, in the definition of Edward Said, is portrayed. So And yes, I mean, I do know enough about American history about minstrels. You know, it's how it's used. You know, if the purpose of it is to get alums from the 50s to be nostalgic for that and to give more money. You know, I remember when I went to, when I was in law school, I went to the Boston On the Shoulders of Giants capital campaign, and Tom Wolfe, who I can say is a very good acquaintance. I mean, he remembered me after my experience on the board with him, and actually chatted with me quite a deal, much to the, I think, the shock of the Boston Brahmin alumni crowd, like, who are you? And Tom Wolfe. And my date at the evening, it was really nice, but her reaction, I'm trying to think where she had gone to undergraduate. I think she'd gone to Columbia. She's like, there are no women in these pictures. Do you realize that the Capital Campaign film has no women? It's like all these men. And so I had to say, well, you know, they're trying to raise money, and these are the people who give them money, and I guess that's what they want to reflect. Will I be offended by the minstrels? I don't know. I didn't know that the university had minstrel shows. I didn't think about that. Maybe that's part of what my father objected to about riding the train, was it the City of New Orleans or the Crescent up to Washington, D.C. with Washington and Lee and UVA students?
Well, apparently it was a big social event of the year. What I have and what my plan is, I have an interview that I did with the person who for several years was the head guy in blackface. And I have an interview with him, and I didn't even mention the minstrel show, although it was on my list of things to mention. He brought it up, and he started talking about it, and what he said was, I understand now that we shouldn't have done that.
That's good.
And to me, from my perspective, using that photograph of him there and his reflection on it today, together, from my perspective, will be very powerful, especially for those who haven't gotten to where he is yet. But I want to know, when you open that book, will you even read what it says on the page, or will you be so offended by seeing that picture? And I'm not trying to put you in a corner. I'm asking your opinion as someone who saw something in that picture, Travelers Grave, that I didn't see.
I will read what it says. I mean, I'm not going to be so offended that I won't read it. I mean, unfortunately, what I'm doing now, you know, you have to read the most offensive thing. Mm-hmm. I mean, in some ways, it's worse than, you know, my brief career as a lawyer. Because, you know, then you were reading usually people's personal, intimate experiences that they never expected would be published in a law firm, printed, and then taken out into court. You know, I'm reading stuff that governments and government agents and other historians wrote that were the most base, racist, chauvinistic thing. I mean, that's what the historiography of, you know, 30, 40 years ago was. I mean, a lot of it was. Mm-hmm. So that's the difference. You know, my reaction to someone of color is, well, why is he saying that? Is he saying it because he runs a company today and he thinks that it's inappropriate to have those types of images, or that they should have done it? Or does he see really that that was wrong? Or you know, my cynical reaction would be, well, why do you think you shouldn't have done it in that day? I mean, I don't know how I'm going to react when I see it. I mean, I'm sure I'm going to be sort of shocked. I mean, well, maybe not. I don't know. I'm not saying not to use it. I think it could serve. I mean, I really don't know what the point of the book is. I don't know if this is, a tool to use money or whatever. The purpose of it.
The celebration of Washington and Lee in 250 years. My goal in putting it together is to have people recognize themselves, recognize their time period, recognize the tradition that they had heard about, and the things that they've heard about have happened since they were there.
Well, that was a tradition that wasn't shared with me. I didn't get a pristine picture of Washington and Lee.
I must say, Willard, if I hadn't found that photograph, I would never know about it, that's for sure. Although, no, that's not true, because now he and another person have brought it up in their interviews, people from that time period.
Which
makes it very clear to me that it was a perfectly normal part of their lives that they didn't question. And let's face it, that was 50s, and that was Washington and Lee, and that is what happened. But what I'm pleased is that they're now questioning whether they should have done.
Yeah, now that's...
And I'm also pleased that I didn't have to say, aren't you questioning having done that? That it's coming from them, that they're saying, maybe we shouldn't have done that, or we shouldn't have done
that. It can be quite embarrassing, as it appears as a picture, depending on what they do, to have that show up today in today's world. If someone was a director of Philip Morris and they did that even 40 years ago, I think if I was an African American employee of the company, I would have to be like, okay. I'm not shocked. I'm just shocked that you were stupid enough to let someone take a picture of you doing it.
But nobody would have thought twice about it then. Because it was a big social event. It would have been like going to fancy dress.
Fancy dress was, there were themes of fancy dress that were, I boycotted fancy dress one year.
Tell me about that.
I can't remember what the theme was. It may have been...
The Dark Continent, or...
Well, that's...
Or the Reconciliation Ball.
It was a Reconciliation Ball, but it was a Dark Continent that contributed to it, because it had been, not just black students, but students who were sensitive to how black students felt, who said, look, we just went through this with Dark Continent. And, Reconciliation Ball wouldn't have been so bad, except, the props that they had set up were like the Old South. They were going to have cotton. Not burnt cotton fields, but cotton. And a huge Confederate flag. I don't think that it would have been the concept of reconciliation. I think it was the presentation. That's a problem for Americans. What was more egregious was that it was at Washington and Lee. With fine scholars like Holt Moach and other people there. People should know that wasn't. That wasn't what happened initially, but people are selective in what they want to believe in and what they want to rally around in.
And yet, it's my understanding that the faculty would not get involved in fancy dress issues.
They didn't. They didn't. There were faculty members who ended up not going, who understood what black students at the university felt. And there were lots of people who weren't, lots of students who were white who chose not to go that year. Surely not enough that caused there to be a financial problem. It wasn't horribly noticed, but, didn't go. That was just an example. There was a picture, I think, that year of a faculty member taken with one of the pictures submitted by a fraternity house with a lawn statue of a black jockey. You know, these things, they come, and the faculty member apologized profusely. And, you know, taken individually, you could always make these excuses, but, you know, they continue to happen. This was the fact. I mean, this is the stuff that I would bring up to John Wilson during Fraternity Renaissance. It was like, well, look what these people are doing. Mm-hmm. And there were great things that, you know, had in the days when I had been, you know, a lawyer in law school, we would have been laughed for not connecting these issues. But you know, that's my perspective of being someone black in this society. I mean, I don't have the luxury to say these are all isolated incidents. But I don't either say that they're not a conspiracy. I mean, this is just the mentality that persists in the country. And I don't think it's something that people think about. I'm sure there were people in that photograph that thought that either we're going to take the picture right here because this is in it, and I think someone actually was maybe touching it too, may have had an elbow on it or something. And they probably thought it was something stupid and funny. I can't get into the psychology whether they thought they were really making a racist statement.
Did it make it into the yearbook?
Oh yeah, I mean that's how it came out. The 6,000 copies or 7,000 copies had been printed. And it's there. So.
I need to clarify, because I've just been working on the fancy dress chapter, and the person who wrote the chapter implies that peace was found in the controversy over the Reconciliation Ball, and that everybody, once they understood what the ball was about, everybody backed down and everybody was happy and everybody went. You're saying that's not the case.
No, I definitely did not go. I thought that there were faculty members who did not go that year. I know there were other black students who did not go.
It seemed a little tidy the way he described what happened.
I mean, I'll
talk to some other people and get, make sure that we have an accurate picture here.
I can't, you know, I want to say that I thought I remembered the L-Rods didn't go.
Good, I'll talk to them.
I could be completely wrong. I mean, it became a discussion, I remember, because my faculty advisor, who I was taking the Survey American History course from, David Parker, took great pains to explain to the class, since we were studying America 1865 to the present, what was wrong with, actually, what he did was he had us explain to him what was wrong with the fancy dress, not as a conception, the reconciliation title, that was wonderful, but what was wrong with it as presented. And he did a, you know, in a class of 20 students. He I thought he did a good job. But I don't remember exactly what happened. I mean, I know I did not attend.
A while ago, you alluded to that you were in the, you're the last class who was in touch with the last all-male class. So, in your time at Washington and Lee, coeducation, I assume, was a real factor. You were aware of its newness?
Oh, yeah. I had the utmost respect for that first class of women. Because I suspect what they went through was terribly difficult. I remember being at Jim Brooks's house in New Orleans after I'd just been accepted, and my father came with me, and we went to his house for a reception for Washington and Lee and the students who accepted. And an older alumnus, very, very big man, came up to me and said, "Son, there's some things that you shouldn't change about Washington and Lee." And I was just like, "Oh my God, I can't believe this is happening. I've just arrived here." And he said, he turned around and he said, "See that little woman over there? Sweetbriar, class of 56. And I was like, "Okay." And I was like, "Oh, that's coeducation." And I figured that out. I was friends with some of the women in that class. I was particularly friends or good acquaintances with Alston Parker, Alston Page Parker. Did you ever get to interview Alston? I don't know if she's living in this country anymore, but Alston was from Valdosta, Georgia. She was in that class, and they just represented so much of what Washington and Lee was. And much like the minority students, those women were in some ways overachievers. They were involved in 2 and 3 organizations. Everything they did, a lot of what they did was always interpreted by so many men as a challenge to the status quo and to the system, but it wasn't. I mean, they were just trying to get an education and enjoy the same things that they were. And there was, you know, there was animosity sometimes between the women from the women's colleges and those women, and I don't think that they're in those early classes, and even in our class, I don't think that there were too many great friendships ever developed. But I had a lot of respect for them. I remember the women below us. I think I was in Gillum dorm. They ended up putting potted plants in the men's urinals, still in their bathroom. I thought it was creative.
I need to pop a new tape.